So this morning, we're going to take a look at one final part of the Pentateuch, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. What we're looking at this morning is a portion of Scripture that seems so far removed from 21st century North America that when we read it, we might really struggle to understand, to even understand the story that's being told in their time and place, let alone how does it connect with us? How is it actually useful for us to help us learn how to live well? This morning we're going to talk about sacrifices. The life and practice of ancient peoples, especially in the ancient Near East, it was filled with sacrifices. Altars, temples, people coming, and this systems of bringing objects and animals and, in some cases, people to be killed as a part of their work to honor gods, please gods, appease gods, curry favor from the gods. Temples and sacrifices were a dominant part of the ancient world. For the Hebrew people, we've already, in the last few weeks, talked about where the Pentateuch is coming from as they've come out of Egypt and they're setting themselves up as a nation and they're establishing what it looks like to live as a nation and to maintain their place as a nation. For these people with their roots and their place in the ancient Near East, there was all they would have known was sacrifices and sacrificial systems. I mean, they came out of Egypt where there were thousands of gods and temples were all over the place. And every other nation around them had similar types of setup and structure. For them to conceive of a life without sacrifices is something that was impossible for them. As hard as it is for us to conceive of a life where you would have to make sacrifices, where you would have to take animals and see them slaughtered on a regular basis to appease a god or to get forgiveness, as hard as it is for us to conceive that, and I suspect for most of us, unless we have spent time in some other parts of the world where this is still a part of what they do, we can't even comprehend it. As hard as it is for us, it would have been harder for them because at least we can read history and understand that it happened. They had no concept of any type of context where sacrifices weren't essential and essential to part of what they lived. So when we get to this part of their story, this makes perfect sense within their context, within their story, within the place where they're living. And so God, in His love, reached down to these people in their place and in their time and met them in a way that they needed because they couldn't conceive of anything else. They needed this, and so God gave it to them. Instructions regarding sacrifices. If you have your Bible, or if you have a device that has a Bible on it, or there's a Bible in front of you underneath one of the seats, you can turn to the book of Leviticus, the third book of the Bible. And we're going to start at chapter 1. We aren't going to read the whole thing, but you can track with me while we work our way through chapter 1 through partway through chapter 6. Because this is where the sacrifices, the different kinds of sacrifices, are introduced. We'll look at the specific passages in a moment, but before we get into the uniqueness of the different kinds of sacrifices, let's first know the names of them. We had a PowerPoint that wasn't that we ran into some technical difficulties. So there was a handout. I don't know if we ran out of them, but we ran out. That's my fault. So some of you have a handout. If you didn't, you can at least hear what the sacrifices are. So I like to use rhythm to help me remember some things. So the sacrifices are in a different order than what's on your sheet: reparation, purification, burnt grain, peace. Reparation, purification, burnt grain, peace. Why don't you try saying that with me? Reparation, purification, burnt grain, peace. Again, reparation, purification, burnt grain, peace. I don't like to compare my children, but the first service was way better. No, let's try it again. Reparation, purification, burnt grain, peace. Those are the five sacrifices. Reparation, purification, burnt grain, peace. Now that we got the names of them down, let's explore what each of them were about. The uniqueness of the sacrifices. We're going to look at them, try and understand their story, try and relate to their story, and then connect this with Jesus. is what we've been doing throughout this series. So the first one was the burnt sacrifice. In the editors of the Bible, when they put in chapters and verses, basically they put the burnt offerings as the first chapter of Leviticus. Leviticus chapter 1. And for burnt offerings, there was different kinds of animals that were brought depending on the setting, but it was male, it was a bull or a ram or a male bird that was brought, and it had to be perfect, flawless, no defect. And when they brought this sacrifice, this was the only one that was completely burnt up. The other ones, they're kind of parts of it are burnt up, or it's kind of more like a barbecue, or they eat it later. This one, well, it depends on how well you barbecue. This one was completely burnt up. It was completely consumed by the fire. And they would bring the male animal without defect, and they would put it on the altar, and it would get completely consumed by the fire. The purpose of the burnt offering, if you read through, it talks about worship. It talks about atonement, although atonement happens more later, and we'll talk a bit about what that is. But really, it's about a connection, about connecting with God. This idea that, hey, we can bring these burnt offerings and we can keep this kind of lifeline open with God so that when we got to talk to him about other stuff, we know he's there still. That's really what it was about. It's this connection with the divine, connection for the Jewish context, connection with Yahweh. That was the burnt offering. And then you get through the burnt offering, you get to chapter 2. You get to the grain offering. The grain offering, as it seems to indicate, as the name indicates, was not an animal sacrifice. It was a grain sacrifice. And so sometimes it was just grain. Sometimes it was made into flour. Sometimes it was with olive oil mixed with incense. Sometimes it was baked bread, but always without leaven for this sacrifice. So this is the grain offering. It was the bread, basically. And the grain offering, the grain sacrifice, was one of thanksgiving. It was a way of recognizing God's goodness and provision, saying, hey, God, thanks for what you've given us here. I'm going to say thank you and give this back to you. Now, even as they give it back to God, it was used then to feed the priests who were there. It was an act of devotion. The grain offering was actually modeled after or very similar in form to what would have to happen if you were working someone else's land. So to use medieval kind of language, if you were a vassal of someone else's land where they owned the land, but you were working it for them. And you didn't get to keep everything. You took a part of what you grew every year and you took it as a tribute to honor your Lord. In this period of time, the grain offering is very much like that, recognizing that this is actually God's land, that we are working for him. And so we're bringing this tribute to God as a way of honoring you and pleasing this God. That is the grain offering, chapter 2. Chapter 3 brings us to the peace offering, or in many translations it's called the fellowship offering. Because the heart of peace, the shalom, is unity. Really, this fellowship. We've kind of watered down the word fellowship and lost the sense of what peace was, this relational peace. But that relational peace was absolutely essential to this third kind of offering. And what they would bring for the fellowship offering would be an animal without defect or a variety of breads. And this was worship, this was thanksgiving, but it was also fellowship. It was also, we're here together in this. And the grain offering is interesting. Sorry, the peace offering is interesting because it was a communal one, which they would then sit and eat together. This is the best kind of sacrifice. We're going to give it so that we get to eat it. But anyway, that was what this one was. That God initiated this sacrifice that was about them coming together and enjoying it together. Then we get to chapter 4, and the next sacrifice goes from chapter 4 through to the first bit of chapter 5. And this is the purification offering, often called just the sin offering. I prefer the term purification because it helps to recognize some of what they felt about this offering, why they needed this offering. What they had to bring for the offering depended on the status of the person. So if it was the high priest or on behalf of the whole community, they had to bring a bull, a full-grown, without defect bull. If it was a significant leader in the community, religious leader, then they had to bring a male goat. If it was a common person, then they had to bring a female goat or a lamb. A poor person could bring a dove or a pigeon. A very poor person could bring a small amount of the finest flour. So it depended on your status as to what you had to bring. And the purification offering, the sin offering, it was about, you know, I've done something wrong. I have broken a law. I have disappointed, disobeyed God. And as a result of me doing something wrong, I have become defiled. I am unclean. I am marked by this sin that I have done. And so the sin offering was about A, acknowledging that you'd done something wrong, finding atonement for, finding release from what I've done, forgiveness of sin, and then that cleansing of that defilement. And what's interesting about this sin offering is that it's whether it was intentional or unintentional. We like to say, well, it wasn't on purpose, so, and we kind of excuse things. But this actually says, even if you do it completely unknowingly, you're still defiled by it. You're still dirty because of it. See, if you have a disease, they had this idea is that if you got certain diseases, it was because you'd done something wrong, because you're unclean now. And so that would be counted as a sin offering, where you've got to try and become cleansed from this thing that you had on you. That still counts as a purification offering. So that you could be cleansed again, get rid of that defilement, so you could come back into worship, come back into community. They had this sense that you would be defiled and you needed to not only be forgiven, but be cleansed from this thing that you had. And so you had to bring these sacrifices. They had to bring these sacrifices as a part of that process, the sin offering. The last kind of sacrifice, which really starts in about chapter 5, verse 14, if you have an NIV Bible, it might say the guilt offering. I prefer the term reparation offering, because guilt is kind of feels very connected to the sin offering. The reparation offering is about needing to make amends. So it's kind of like the sin offering plus. And that plus was basically a 20% additional fine that you had to pay to make amends. If you desecrated or broke something that was considered holy, then you didn't just make sure it was replaced. You had to do the offering to appease your guilt, to get rid of the dirty that was on you, so to speak. You had to replace it, and you had to pay 20% additional. If you accidentally or on purpose took something from your neighbor and you were found out, then in order to be cleansed and welcome back in, you not only had to do the guilt sacrifice, the guilt offering, but you had to do this 20% extra. So you'd pay back over and above what was taken or what was broken or what was damaged. It's reparation for what you have done. And this is rooted in this idea that we often still hold to today regularly, is that you gotta make amends for it. You gotta make up for what you've done. It's not enough just to replace it. Like, you've caused harm over and above the thing itself. You've got to make amends for it. And so they put in this sort of fixed 20% over and above the value of it. You've got to pay that. With each of these sacrifices, you start to see a human need that they had, that this sacrifice was given to meet. They had this need that they wanted to connect with the divine. And so they're given this burnt offering to maintain that connection. They had a need to thank God and honor God and please God, you know, to sort of pay, to show that they were grateful for what they were given. And so they put in place this grain offering. There was a need to be in this thing together. And so this peace offering, this fellowship offering is put in place so that they could practice this in community with others. There was a need to get rid of this defilement so that they wouldn't have this uncleanness on them anymore. And so God puts in place this purification offering so they don't have to wonder, am I still dirty or will God accept me? And so he gives them this purification offering so that they can know that they've been cleansed and be accepted and find forgiveness. And then the reparation, the guilt offering, there's this need to be able to make things up to someone when you've done something to cause harm. And perhaps more significantly to some, I need others to make things up to me. And so this reparation offering, this extra 20% was built in to meet these needs. When you start to think about the need that was being met through the different sacrifices, they kind of make sense. These needs are still commonly felt needs, even in a very secular 21st century Canadian context. Different individuals feel those things differently and acknowledge the feelings differently, but most of us can relate to those needs. We may not use biblical language to identify the needs, but most of us can relate to them in some way, shape, or form. The need to be connected to the divine. We may not even use divine language. We might just refer to things like higher power or something bigger than ourselves. And that's something that that even the most secular people often still have this sense, like, I just need to be connected to something bigger than me. There's something more going on and I want to be connected to it. Even if they don't put any spiritual language to it. Or the need to honor a higher good. The need to be a part of actually contributing to something bigger than themselves. Not just acknowledge it, not just be connected to it, but be a part of feeding into it. It's a very human need. Many, many people who are completely secular, have no sense of spirituality, have the sense that, you know, I need to be a part of helping this charity because I feel good, because I feel like I'm contributing something bigger than me. And they have this need to sort of show that and honor that. For some people, that bigger thing might be nothing more than their personal pleasure. But it moves beyond just gain to actually enjoying it and feel like, well, when I enjoy it, when I do this fun stuff, I feel like I'm a part of something more. The need to be in this thing with others. The need to be in community. Most in our world live with a sense of wanting to belong, and wanting to be a part of something with other people. And even in one of the fascinating things about today's era is even those who bury themselves in their houses and don't go out for extended periods of time are seeking that online, just chasing after it in different types of virtual communities online. The need for acceptance and forgiveness to feel like I don't have dirty on me, if you will. I'm not defiled. It's a huge need for people. And sometimes we get it by trying to do enough good things to outweigh the bad. Other times we chase that need being met by comparing ourselves to others. Well, at least, you know, I'm not that bad. I'm not like that, so I'm okay. Others of us find ourselves chasing it with things that are almost like penance, you know, where it's like, well, yeah, but you don't know what I've done. So I need to do this stuff to make up for all this stuff that I've had in my past. This need for restitution. That's the need for acceptance, forgiveness. The last one, need for restitution or amends. To be able to close the book on the past and to move forward. I suspect in a room this size, there are many of us that in some way, shape, or form, we look back and we can remember something. It may not have even been a significant something, but you're like, oh, I wish I could go back and make it up to that person. I wish I could go back and make up for that thing that, you know, I never told them about. Nobody other than me knows about it. And I wish I could go back and fix that. And we can actually sometimes get caught in a cycle of chasing, you know, trying to make up for stuff. Or maybe we look back and we feel like somebody else should have done more to make things up to us. That, yeah, amends needs to happen, but somebody owes me. And I didn't get what I deserved to make up for what was taken from me. Or to how I was harmed. This need for amends shows up even in 12-step programs, in AA. Step 8 is about making a list of all the persons you've harmed and be willing to make amends to them all. Step 9 is make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. This idea of making amends is very, very common. We feel like we've got to sort of close the book on the past so that we can move forward. And the only way you can do that is by making things right again. When you start looking at the needs that we feel compared to the needs that were felt in the ancient world where these sacrifices were meant to meet them, it's very easy to see ourselves in their story. Ourselves in what they were chasing, what they were trying to get appeased, what they were trying to find through these sacrifices. But there was a problem with the sacrifices, and that was that the chase for those things never ended with sacrifices. The chase for those needs being met was never fully found through a sacrificial system. The connection they received to the divine, the honor they gave in the community they found, the forgiveness they received, the restitution that they gave, it was for a moment until the next time. Or until the next time, and until the next time. And it became a constant cycle of making sure, oh, have I done it right yet? Have I made sure that the sacrifice has happened? And this constant process that was never, ever, ever going to end. The sacrificial system was a gift to them because it was definitely more clear and it met the needs that they had in that moment. But it also was a reminder of the futility of any system to really, truly meet what humanity needs at a deep, significant level. People stuck to it because it was all they knew. It was the only possible hope they had. Same as happens with any religion. But it also paved the way for a lot of evil. One of those ways it paved the way for evil is like, well, hey, if I know that I do this, if I do this thing, all I have to do is make the sacrifice and it's paid for, then if the sacrifice isn't that costly to you, then hey, I can just go do this evil thing and I'm good. And it actually starts to work against what it was trying to do because people start to feel like they're guilt-free because they've been able to just do this thing over here. And they can live however they want over here as long as they make up for it on the other side. And so it became a license to do all kinds of things that weren't good because people could just check the religious box and say, yeah, but I did that, so I'm good. No problem. And the community as a whole couldn't say, no, it is a problem. Well, because their whole system said it was fine. And the sacrifices were pretty specific. One of the things that clearly happened, and Jesus, the only time we really see him go off, it's because of this, is the sacrifices were pretty specific. And maybe not everybody had what they needed to make the sacrifice. So if I have extras, I can make a little money on the side. You need to offer that kind of bird? I have one or two. Oh, you need to sacrifice a lamb without defect? How about this one? Sell it to you for a significant profit. Because if you don't buy it, you can't make the sacrifice. You're not right with God. You're not right with community. How much is it worth to you? And so it actually started this business of people selling what was needed for sacrifices. What was given as a gift became a burden for many and an opportunity for others. It became oppression for some and it became power for others. Rather than truly meeting needs, it exposed them to an even greater extent. And into that setting, hundreds of years later, Jesus is born. Into that setting, hundreds of years later, Jesus went to the cross claiming to be a sacrifice for many. And if you look at the needs that people were longing for, Jesus came to meet them all. For example, the burnt offering, designed to help people keep that connection with God. Jesus came inviting people to come to him for their connection with God. In Matthew 11, he said, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." In John 5, he looked at the Pharisees, the ones who were maintaining this system of how to get to God. And he said, you study the scriptures diligently, thinking that through them you're going to get to God. But they testify about me and you refuse to come to me to have life. And in John 14, he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. You don't keep that connection through these burnt offerings. You get it through me. Then you get the grain offering. People wanting to come and pay this tribute to God. Jesus comes and invites people to stop bringing this offering. Just bring yourself. You come to me. John 4, when he interacts with a Samaritan woman at the well, and they get into this debate about which kind of worship was right. Was it the Samaritan way or was it the Jewish way? And he says, a time is coming and has now come when those who worship me will worship in spirit and in truth. Those are the kinds of worshipers the Father seeks. It's not about where you worship or what you're bringing. It's about you coming with the right heart. Romans 12, Paul picks this up when he says, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Bring yourself, just come to me. You don't need to be appeased with all this other stuff. You can come. And the peace offering. Jesus didn't just come to save individuals. He came declaring his kingdom was coming and inviting people to come together as a part of this new kind of kingdom, this new kind of community. Paul talks about it in Galatians, where this new kind of community has people from all different backgrounds and contexts, slave, free, male, female, Jew, Gentile, all being one together in Christ. He invites them into this new family. He uses the image of family, this new kingdom. And it's significant that at the end of his life, before he went to the cross, he co-opted the Passover meal as this new family meal that he encouraged people to participate in on a regular basis to remember that we are in this thing together. We take this communion meal to remember that he's got us all in this together. It's not just me and him. It's me and us and him together. Purification. He came inviting full and complete forgiveness, not through the blood of sheep and goats, but through him. Probably the most profound summary of this is found in Hebrews 10. Let me read from Hebrews 10 for you. It says, first he said, sacrifices and offerings, burnt offerings and sin offerings, you did not desire, nor were you pleased with them. That's a quote from Psalm 40, which is interesting that even in the Old Testament, he's already starting to say that that's not the stuff that pleases God. Though they were offered in accordance with the law. Then he said, here I am, I have come to do your will. He set aside the first to establish the second. And by that will, we have been made holy through the sacrifice of the body of Jesus Christ once and for all. Day after day, every priest stands and performs his religious duties. Again and again, he offers the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when this priest had offered for all time one sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. And since that time, he waits for his enemies to be made his footstool. For by one sacrifice, he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. The Holy Spirit also testifies to us about this. First, he says, this is the covenant I will make with them after that time, says the Lord. I will put my laws in their hearts and will write them on their minds. Then he adds, their sin and lawless acts I will remember no more. And where these have been forgiven, sacrifice for sin is no longer necessary. Radical teaching to people who are raised in a sacrificial system. The first pointing out that those sacrifices never actually pleased God. They were given to them because they needed them. But it says God was never happy with them. It wasn't him that wanted them. They were given for the sake of the people, not for God. Jesus came as the high priest and offered a sacrifice himself once for all to show that these sacrifices, that this system, and that any kind of system, is over. It says, listen to the things that are offered through Jesus. Verse 14, it says, people are made perfect forever. That's removal of defilement. Verse 17, that people have had their sins forgotten. Not just forgiven, forgotten. Verse 18 is forgiven. And again in verse 18, it says there's no more sacrifices. You have this freedom in life. One of the most beautiful things Jesus did was he invited people into a radical radically different way of thinking, of discovering life in him that was something that they could never have imagined before. The system of defilement worked this way. If I'm dirty, I'm unclean. If I touch someone or something else when I am dirty, they become unclean. And if that unclean person touches somebody else, then that person becomes unclean. One of the laws that we read last week that sounded really strange about women's bleeding, it indicated that. If she's bleeding, she's unclean. So if she sits on a chair, then it becomes unclean. And if somebody else sits on that chair, then they become unclean. And it's like, you got to stay away from any uncleanness because it just keeps spreading. And so when people got a disease, like a leper, they would walk around the city. They were kicked out of the community. They walk around saying, I'm unclean, I'm unclean, I'm unclean. That wasn't just because they were afraid of other people getting it. It was also a very ceremonial thing that says, if you touch me, you're defiled too. And you'll have to go through all of this ritual cleansing so that you won't be defiled anymore. That was how things worked in the old system. That was how they thought about everything in the old system. Jesus shows up and does something inconceivable before he comes. What happened when Jesus touched the leper? The leper became clean. Jesus wasn't defiled. They became clean. What happened when the woman who was bleeding for 20 years touched Jesus' robe? She became clean. The bleeding stopped. He didn't get dirty. Suddenly, it switched from the unclean spreading to the clean spreading to those who were unclean. Totally flips it on its head. And when Jesus' followers were sent out, they were able to do the same kinds of things. I don't think the main reason we have the stories of the miracles that the disciples did was to show how just incredibly powerful God was. It's a part of this undoing of this old system, where the unclean spreads and starts showing, no, those who are found whole and clean and free in Jesus, that can spread to others. We can share this with others. Even in churches today, too many churches and too many of us spend our time worried about being touched by the unclean, rather than being so confident in what Jesus has done for us that we can go out and actually make a difference out there in a world that needs it. Totally flips the system on its head. Instead of a constant cycle of defilement and cleansing, he invites us to enjoy complete and whole cleansing in him that stretches out to others as we reach out and touch those and the things that are dirty in the world. And then reparation. Just very, very quickly. The way Jesus deals with reparation is not through directly talking about it, but rather introducing two principles that make this whole, that completely undermine the system of reparation, that you got to pay 20% extra to make everything better. The first thing he introduces is radical generosity. He comes and says, you need to be people who are just overwhelmingly generous. When you come and meet with me and discover what you have in a connection with God, you should be people who overflow with what you give out. People who aren't bound by a 10% tithing law or a 20% reparation law or 33% tithing. Rather, he would have us be people who show love and care and are radically loving, radically giving in our love. He talks about us being people who sow generously. Apostle Paul does in 2 Corinthians. But my favorite example of what could happen when people really discover this is in the story of Zacchaeus. Sometimes stories show it way better. Zacchaeus was a tax collector. He had made a lot of money ripping people off. And he was considered unclean by everyone around him. And yet Jesus meets with him and goes to his house. And in response to interacting with Jesus and discovering that connection with Jesus isn't, you know what, you're right, I've messed up. I need to go pay an extra 20% so I can make amends for everything. That's not his response. His response is, I'm going to give half of everything I've got to the poor. And anybody I've ripped stuff off from, I'm giving four times back. It's this radical response that goes so far beyond what was necessary. He could have done the 20% and everyone would have had to say, well, he's done it. He's checked the box. He's good. But his connection with Jesus led him to do something so much more radical that make that idea of amends seem irrelevant and meaningless. And the other thing that Jesus introduces and calls us to is probably one of the most radical teachings that Jesus ever gave. And that is forgiveness. You know, the other side, you know, yeah, but they owe me. Yeah, but they messed this up for me, and so I've got to get this back from them. Jesus invites his people into a radical forgiveness. Peter comes to Jesus and says, you know, how many times do I have to forgive somebody that wrongs me? Seven times? Seven was a lot. And he's like, no, 70 times seven. It's meant to be hyperbole, meant to be this number. They say, I can't do that. That's the point. It's this radical sense of forgiveness. And if we as followers of Jesus begin to move into these ideas of radical generosity and radical forgiveness, this 20% making amends thing just seems puny and meaningless. Becomes archaic. Jesus calls us and invites us and models for us something far bigger and far more profound. He meets all of these needs that we long for. And we're invited to find in him the fulfillment of all of them. And a fulfillment that is so complete and profound and life-altering that we never want to go back to sacrifices. And we never want to get stuck in a system again. We never want to get sucked back into religion because we have life in him. One of the most profound statements Jesus ever made was a one-word pronouncement just before he died on the cross. In Greek, it's one word, tetelestai. In English, we translate it into three words. It is finished. Or it is completed. What is the it that's finished or completed? Was it his life? Sure, yeah. His work, to a certain extent. But I believe it also refers to this entire way of being that his people and all of humanity had been caught in, trying to chase down what they needed. He came and completed that chase, that striving. The system was completed in him. The striving is over for us. In him, we're invited to find life and vibrancy in our very being. Connected to the divine, a part of the greatest good, brought into a family, fully forgiven and freed to give and receive radical generosity and forgiveness. Before Jesus died, he set up communion, the Lord's Supper, as something for us to remember his sacrifice for us. And we're going to participate in this before we go. And as we do, I'd like us just to focus on, like, it's done. All of that stuff, all of those needs, the things I feel like I have to chase after, it's all done in him. And we're celebrating that when we eat and drink together. I'm going to invite the music team to come. And we're going to sing a song while we prepare to eat and drink together.